Tonight, I want to look at the impact of Methodism. And I suppose when I say that, the first thing that most people will think about is the spread of the Methodist community throughout the world. It started in England. From England, it came to Ireland. From Ireland, it went to America. From America, it went to the continent of Europe. Interestingly, coming back across the Atlantic. And you find other chains like that of service from one place to another. Until now, the Methodist community throughout the world numbers over 70 million. And there isn't an area of the world where Methodism hasn't found some foothold. In fact, the Irish have played a significant part in that, because bearing in mind our numbers, and we never numbered much more than 60,000, we have sent more missionaries overseas than anybody else has done. We're a very missionary-minded nation, thanks, I think, to the Peregrini, the Celtic monks that took the gospel back to Europe after the Dark Ages. But I don't really want to talk about that. I want to talk about the impact of Methodism on people who never became Methodists. Because it is possible to influence people who don't come into the church. And the first note I have brought with me is the one that I want to start by discussing for just a few minutes. The name of William Edward Hartpole Lecky may not be familiar to very many. You will find a wall monument to him in St. Patrick's Cathedral. He was born in Dublin. He went to school first in a place called Kingstown, which is now known as Dunleary. He then went to Armagh Royal School, and after that he went to Cheltenham. He next came to Trinity College in Dublin, where he graduated, and then went over to England and began to work on history. And his magnum opus is a history of England in the 18th century, which he published between 1878 and 1890. There are 12 volumes of it. Not exactly light reading. I haven't read the 12 volumes. In fact, I haven't read any of them. But I have come across quotations from him, and it's from John Telford's biography of John Wesley, published in 1947, that I want to read a reference to Lecky. This is what Lecky says. Although the career of the elder Pitt and the splendid victories by land and sea that were won during his ministry form unquestionably the most dazzling episodes in the reign of George II. They must yield, I think, in real importance to that religious revolution which shortly before had begun in England by the preaching of the Wesleys and Whitfield. Lecky assigns to Methodism a prominent place among those influences which saved England from the revolutionary spirit which laid France in ruins, and shows how peculiarly fortunate it was that the vast extension of manufacturing industry in the later part of the century had been preceded by a religious revival which opened a mainspring of moral and religious energy among the poor, and at the same time gave a powerful influence to the philanthropy of the rich. Now that is a remarkable tribute to the work of John Wesley and his brother and George Whitefield, that their religious work in the second half of the 18th century saved England that sort of bloodbath that overtook France in the days of the French Revolution. England did have its revolution. The life of the English changed in many ways, but it was done without that ghastly upheaval that was the experience of the French. Nobody went out to slaughter the aristocrats. There were a number of moments in the 19th century which were pretty shocking in their own way. Actually, in the 18th century, the earlier one, in 1779, was the series of Gordon riots that mostly troubled London. They're called the Gordon riots from Lord George Gordon, who was the nominal head of them. But I don't think he was responsible for them. I think they wanted an aristocrat at the head. And this poor man, who wasn't quite the full shilling, was the one on whom their choice landed. They were protesting against the extension of civil rights to Catholics. In 1819, the Peterloo massacre happened in Manchester. Now, the word massacre suggests to you thousands of dead. What actually happened was that a group of people met in St. Peter's Fields to ask for radical reform of the English law to allow justice for those who were in the lower echelons of society. The place was packed and the magistrates panicked. The people who were gathered in the field had no violent intention, but the magistrates didn't trust them. They were, after all, the landlords. So they loosed the dragoons on them. 11 died, and somewhere in the region of 500 were injured. And what is fascinating is that nothing arose from that. It wasn't the cause of violent protest. The protests were quite peaceful. We shall come to the Tolpuddle martyrs in a minute, but in 1838, from 1838 to 1848, the Chartists had a number of demonstrations around the country looking for a charter for the lower classes, similar to the Magna Carta that in the reign of King John helped the more important people in the country as it was then managed. But none of these produced the sort of horrific effect that happened in France. And Lecky is quite sure that the reason why it didn't happen was that the poor, the downtrodden, if you like, the labourers, had been encouraged in religious and ethical revolution, and therefore were quite quiet in the way they generally reacted. And there was an opening of benevolence among those who could afford to be benevolent. I want to cross to the other side of the Atlantic for a few moments. 1783 was the year in which the colonies in North America achieved their independence from the British Empire and became the United States of America. There on the eastern side of the continent, the United States would eventually spread right across the continent. But for the moment, they had thrown off the British Empire. They had declared themselves independent. In December of 1784, at Christmas time, the Methodists of North America held a conference at Baltimore. The Baltimore Christmas Conference of 1784 represented the Methodist societies in Britain. They, at that point, constituted themselves the Episcopal Methodist Church of America, independent of the Church in England, or of the Methodist societies in England, because Methodism in England did not claim to be a church until 1795, and the Irish took until 1816 to follow suit. So the Methodists were the pioneers in that one. Now, what is interesting about the those dates is that recent American Methodist historians have recognized that the Methodist community in America in the first years of the United States grew exponentially. It seemed to be that more people wanted to be Methodists than were prepared to join any other religious body. And the church grew, the new American Episcopal Church. It split into various ways, but the number of American Methodists swelled exponentially during those years. The historians ascribe it to the fact that Methodists were governed democratically. The voice of the members was heard in its governing councils. And they suggest that that appealed to the democracy of the new United States. The United States saw itself as the people taking over power from the monarch who lived more than 1,000 miles away in England. And they appreciated the democratic style of Methodism. But I think there is another factor involved, and that is the one that I have just mentioned, the Baltimore Christmas Conference. The Methodist Church in America, up to that point, the point of independence of the American Declaration of Independence, had been controlled very largely by preachers sent from England. Wesley every year sent so many preachers to superintend the Methodist societies in the United States, in these what would be the United States, the American colonies. When the Americans threw out the British government, those English Methodist preachers thought it was about time they went home. Life was going to be very insecure for them among the new leaders of America. And only one of them actually remained in America, Francis Asbury. The others left. Now, it was the others who gathered in Baltimore and declared their church, their body, their societies to be an independent church. And I think that would have appealed to the Americans too. You can see the coincidence of dates, only about 18 months between the two, where politically they say we don't want the British to control us anymore. And here is a religious group that says exactly the same. And the impact of Methodism on America was tremendous at that particular period. You will remember that a few evenings ago, I talked about the way in which the Methodist societies survived. Wesley didn't have enough clergy to look after them. They had to look after themselves. Ordinary people working class people, artisans, farm laborers, would have to manage their own religious society. And Wesley supplied the simple agenda of questions that enabled them to do it, questions that survived in the agenda of the quarterly meetings as long as the quarterly meetings survived. Now, that also enabled the working people in England to find a way to organize themselves. And Rattenbury has written a book on the rise of trade unionism in England, which lists the number of trade unions of which the first secretary, the first organizer, was a Methodist. They were bringing the experience they had learned in the Methodist society into their working life. And they were forming groups to look for justice, to look for a fair deal, if you like, from their employers. And a tremendous number of those early societies, of those early trade unions, were managed by Methodist secretaries. I once visited Tolpuddle. Fascinating little place. How many of you have been to Dorsetshire? Yes. There is a little river that rises in the Blackmoor Hills in the north of Dorset and runs all the way down until it joins a slightly larger river, and the two of them together run into Poole Harbour. It's known at various stages as the Piddle, the Poddle, and the Puddle. Not very glorious names for a river when all is said and done. And this river gives their names to several villages on the way, like Piddle Trenthide and Piddle Hinton. And when you get down nearer the bottom, there are six of them with the name Puddle. The only two I can think of at the moment are Athpuddle and Tolpuddle. Tolpuddle was a quiet little village in a rural area. And a group of six agricultural labourers gathered under a tree in Tolpuddle formed themselves into a group to campaign for better wages. At that time, the wages of farm labourers was appallingly low. Unfortunately, the magistrates, as was the case always, were landlords. They were the ones who paid them. They didn't want to have their finances compromised by these wretched people. And so a trial was organized. The six men were put on trial under a judge who was biased, with a jury who was biased. And the Act of Parliament, which they invoked to accuse these men of an illegal assembly, was one that was actually referring only to sailors in the Royal Navy. But the justice didn't matter. What mattered was that these men had to be stopped, and they were accordingly eventually declared guilty and sentenced to be transported to Australia for 10 years. And off they had to go. They were carted away and off to Australia. And there were protests all over the country. They were peaceful protests. Some of them were marches. Petitions went to Parliament. There is a polite fiction in the English legal system that when a verdict is given in a court, it is correct. And therefore, the king couldn't say, well, there was something wrong with this trial, we'll have to set it aside. What he did was he gave a pardon to the four men, forgiving them for doing what they had not done. And they came back. Now, I'm telling you the story of these six men because five of them were Methodists. At least three and possibly four were local preachers. And they have become virtually the patron saints of the labour movement in Britain. At one stage, the Trade Union Congress put a triumphal arch over the gate of the little Methodist chapel in Tolpuddle. Marvellous thing to look at. It's nearly bigger than the chapel itself. But that was the measure of how much they thought of these six men who suffered so much because they wanted to get fair wages for themselves and for others like them. And the trade union movement has never quite forgotten that. It has never forgotten the fact, well, some of its members may forget the fact that there were so many Methodist officers in early days. By the way, they were not Wesleyan Methodists. By the time we come to the 19th century, English Methodism has divided into a number of groups, and the Wesleyan Methodists were beginning to be middle class. The early Methodists were all working class and artisan, but by the 19th century, the Wesleyans were moving up the social scale. They were beginning to be lower middle class or middle class. I don't think they ever quite made up a middle class. Some of them did it later on. But they were beginning to feel they were a little bit grand for trade unions and for labourers' interests. So they didn't get involved in trade unions. The primitive Methodists did. They retained their roots in working class people right through their existence until they joined the Union in 1932. The primitive Methodists were the ones who retained that labouring link. If you go to a trade union meeting in England, you will still find people addressing each other as brother and sister. And that is the language in which the Methodist societies addressed each other. If you go to a printing works and ask to meet the members of the trade union, well, it will be probably the whole printing works now, but the branch of a trade union in a printing works is still to this day called a chapel, a word taken from the 19th century Methodists who met in a chapel. The Methodist chapel was a building. The printing works chapel is simply a group of people. And when the Labour Party meets in conference, it always has a service arranged during the course of the conference, during the Sunday of the conference, in a Methodist chapel, a Methodist church. The links still are remembered. Now, when you stop to think that the impact of the trade union movement around the world has done an immense amount for workers and has enabled them to get a better standard of living than they would otherwise have had, you begin to see where the impact of Methodism is leading us, though probably hardly any of them are Methodists. In fact, I'm sorry that quite a number of Methodists would feel that really a trade union is not the sort of place they want to be in. I think we have lost something, and they have lost something, by that sort of attitude. What strikes me as one of the problems of trade unionism is that it employs full-time paid secretaries. And these men and women are no doubt aware that their union members are going to judge them by what they get for the members. So they've always got to be getting something. And I think that has led to quite a number of abuses in trade unionism. Because the secretaries are a little bit afraid of being sacked if they don't get something more this year. whether it's higher wages, shorter working hours, or whatever. Perhaps a little greater Methodist influence in our trade unions might have been a help to them. But certainly in the early days, it was very, very strong. Let me come on to 1885. Anybody who was in politics in Britain in the late years of the 19th century had to take account of the nonconformist conscience. The nonconformist conscience wasn't an organization, it was a force of which politicians had to take account. It championed the underprivileged, it championed the downtrodden, it championed the poor. And one of the leading voices in the nonconformist conscience was that of Hugh Price Hughes. Hugh Price Hughes was the superintendent minister of the West London Mission. And London, at that period, was riddled with appalling slums. Quite a number of people began to try and do something about them. But Hugh Price Hughes became the editor of the Methodist Times. And in his leading articles and in other items in the paper, trumpeted the need for social reform, the need for better working conditions, the need for better housing, the need to take seriously the problem of the poor and the sick and the elderly. And that exerted a tremendous influence over people throughout England who never became Methodists, but whose cause was taken up by Methodist people thinking seriously about the plight of the poor and the dispossessed. What about here in Ireland? I want to look very briefly at three interesting people, all products of the 19th, 20th centuries. And the first I want to look at is Jasper Wolfe of Skibbereen. Charming man. I have seen his photograph. I have read his biography. He was a solicitor and was so highly regarded as a solicitor that in the last days of the British control in this country, he became the Crown Solicitor in West Cork. And part of his job was to prosecute those criminals who were brought into court by the authorities. If the police were bringing a case against anybody, Jasper Wolfe was the solicitor who would steer the case through the court. And during the late teens of the 20th century, he was prosecuting people charged with IRA outrages. You can imagine the result. 3 times in a period of a few years, different IRA courts sat in judgment on Jasper Wolfe, not in his presence. They had no power to bring him before them, but for prosecuting their brave men, they sentenced him to death. And there was a likelihood that the sentence might be carried out, so he took refuge in England for a short period. Then when the noise had died down a bit, he came back and resumed his job as a solicitor in Skibbereen. The Irish Free State became a reality in 1923, and Jasper Wolfe was no longer Crown Solicitor. There were no Crown Solicitors in Ireland in the days of the Free State. And what is particularly interesting is that the three men who presided over the IRA courts that sentenced Jasper Wolfe to death later became his friends. A remarkable instance of reconciliation, and one worth thinking about. Jasper Wolfe went a little further. In 1926, he was the first Methodist to be elected to a seat in Doyle Éireann, where he sat as an independent. If you go back to 1798, when the Great Rebellion broke out in Ireland, first in Kildare, then in Wexford, then in Antrim, later in Sligo, some of the leaders were members of the Church of Ireland, notably in Wexford. Some of them were Presbyterian. In fact, the minister of Rosemary Street Presbyterian Church in Dublin was sent to jail for encouraging the rebellion. The one group that were not involved in the rising were the Methodists. And the only large meeting of men to occur in this country in 1798 was the Methodist Conference, because the government were satisfied that it would not be seditious. And yet here, a little more than a century later, you have Jasper Wolfe sitting in Doyle Éireann as part of the Free State that was working its way out of British control. I think there is a sense in which you are seeing that here is somebody who will support the powers that be as long as they are valid. And Doyle Éireann, by 1926, certainly was the effective government of this country. Let me move from Jasper Wolfe. Let me talk about Arthur Dean Codling. Arthur Codling was born in Lancashire. His father was born in Norfolk, which is where the name Codling originates. He was a Methodist minister who was stationed in Lancashire. And young Arthur went to school in Lancashire, graduated in London, and found a job in the Home Office in London. He became a civil servant. And the civil service sent him to Dublin to work in the Home Office here, because the Home Office here was a branch of the Home Office in London. And he became an expert on the housing of working people. Then came the change of government. In 1923, the Free State government was taking over. That disturbed an awful lot of people here. The Methodist family in Ireland, the total Methodist family in the Republic, declined by about one third in 10 years. Some of them were people in the army or the navy who withdrew to England. Some of them were civil servants. Some of them were customs officials. Some of them were in the RIC, the Royal Irish Constabulary. And some of them were simply civil servants who had work here. And most of them went. So too did some people who couldn't really face living in a country which wasn't part of the empire. Arthur Dean Codling and his wife, who was also a Lancashire person, and who was incidentally a cousin of his, were offered three possible things to do. They could transfer to London, to the headquarters. They could transfer to Belfast, where the which was part of the new Northern Irish province, or they could stay where they were. Neither wanted to live in London, which they thought was a vast metropolis where you could be terribly lonely. And Arthur didn't want to go to Belfast. He was a Gladstonian liberal, and a portrait of William Ewart Gladstone hung in his dining room for all of his life. So the only choice was to stay here. He stayed in the Department of Internal Affairs, ex-Home Office, for a very short period, and the government then transferred him to finance. They recognized his talents. He climbed very rapidly up the ladder in finance and became the assistant secretary of the department. At one stage, when the secretary was away, he was the acting secretary of the Department of Finance. I corresponded with two men who were strongly influenced by him. One was Kenneth Whittaker, still alive. Kenneth Whittaker was the secretary of the, later the secretary of the Department of Finance, at the time when Sean Lemass became Taoiseach in this country. And in the 1950s, those two began to change the nature of Ireland. They began to move away from de Valera's vision of happy farming people, frugally living in a delightful countryside, maidens dancing at the crossroads and young men engaging in sports, which would probably have reduced the country to beggary if he had gone on much longer. But Whittaker and Lemass arranged for industry to come into Ireland and transformed the country. They were not responsible for what has happened at the head of economic affairs since. The other person whom Arthur Codling strongly influenced was Conor Cruise O'Brien. Conor Cruise O'Brien for a while worked in the Department of Finance. And there was an occasion when Ernest Blythe, the Minister for Finance, had notice of a question that was coming up in Doyle Éireann that would require an answer. And they asked Conor Cruise O'Brien to prepare the facts for him. And somehow O'Brien slipped up. The minister was furious and said so to Arthur Dean Codling. Codling summoned Cruise O'Brien before him. And what Cruise O'Brien wrote to me was this. He said that as he faced Arthur Dean Codling, Codling quietly, in his Lancashire accent, said, "That's not the sort of thing we expect in this department." And he said the chill of the word, so simple, no temper, just the quiet statement, hit home. And he said, has lived with me ever since and made sure that whatever I did conscientiously. Now, think the sort of influence that Conor Cruise O'Brien and Ken Whittaker have had on the politics and economics of this country. And notice that behind them is the influence of a Lancashire man, a Methodist, the son of a Methodist minister, and a lifelong Methodist. By the way, he sat in one of the front pews in Rathgar And while the New Testament was being read, he followed the reading in his Greek Testament. The third one I want to talk about is George F. Beckett. In the last century, towards the end of the last century, there was a building firm of Beckett. I think they called themselves Beckett and Beckett, actually. They were two brothers. Their building contractor's plant was in Sandymount. And at one time, they were building the National Library and the National Museum in Kildare Street. Both men devoted Methodists. Their son followed in their footsteps. Oh, the son of one of them. The son of one of them was George F. Beckett. That interested him in architecture. He designed quite a number of Methodist churches in Ireland, about 10, one of them being the one we're sitting in. He also designed a church that has now disappeared, the church in Ringsend, where I was asked as a young local preacher to preach, and there was George Beckett sitting in the back pew. That was where he always worshipped, until eventually it closed. George Beckett was a man with a deep sympathy for anybody who was in trouble. Ishbel, Lady Aberdeen, wife of the Lord Lieutenant, the Earl of Aberdeen, set up an organization to try and relieve the wants of the poor. And one of those she involved was George F. Beckett. And the particular thing in which Beckett was involved was the provision of playgrounds for the children of the slums. Where, if you lived in a tenement, did your child play? In the streets. And possibly injured by passing traffic, or even killed. And the little group organized a number of playgrounds around the area of central Dublin so that children could play in a certain amount of safety. Later, they decided to have a look at the slums in their entirety. And Beckett made a major contribution into the compilation of a report on the Dublin slums, which were the worst in Europe. They were absolutely frightful. They produced statistics, they produced maps, they produced diagrams, they produced everything to convince the authorities in Dublin that something had to be done about slums. I think the report came out shortly before the Second World War. Here, always, of course, called the emergency. And during that period, there wasn't money for anything of that sort. But when, after the war, the city really began to take seriously the clearance of its slums, and began to move people out of the tenements into healthy suburbs, in small houses with little gardens, then that report was the basis of their doing. And again, you've got the work of George Beckett helping to improve the lot of the city. And it wouldn't at all surprise me to be told that none of the people who moved out of those tenements into those estates had ever heard of his name. It was there in the background. How do I know about these three people? Well, I know about Jasper Wolfe because his son-in-law, a British MP called Ungoyd Thomas, wrote his biography, and I have a copy. The other two I studied, and you will find my account of them in past issues of the Dublin Historical Record. I think there must be scores of other Methodist people who have made similar contributions to Irish life, not within the scope of the Methodist Church officially, but as simply Methodists exercising their ideas of fair play, justice, integrity, and who have made an impact in this or that city or town or village. I haven't got the time to seek them all out. Perhaps you will. Thank you.